Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The American Civil Liberties Union has asked Governor John Kasich to halt executions after the last one ended, well, not like the state had wanted it to last week. The condemned man gasped and choked for several minutes from what appears to be effects of an experimental lethal injection method. The children of Dennis McGuire, who was sentenced to death for the 1989 rape and stabbing death of a young pregnant woman, said they intend to file a lawsuit against the state. Dennis McGuire Jr. likened the execution method to torture.
The agony and terror of watching my dad suffocate to death lasted more than 19 minutes. It was the most awful moment in my life to witness my dad's execution. I can't think of any other way to describe it than torture.
Coming up, we'll learn more about the drug shortage that has forced Ohio and other states to use untested drug mixes for executions. Joining us now to talk about the case is Associated Press legal affairs reporter Andrew Welsh Huggins. Andrew also is the author of a book about the death penalty in Ohio. It's called No Winners Here Tonight: Race, Politics, and Geography in One of the Country's Busiest Death Penalty States. Welcome to the show, Andrew.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Also joining us is OSU law professor and death penalty expert Douglas Berman. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Ann.
Andrew, let's start out with what happened on January 16th. What was Dennis McGuire given in the death chamber? What did you witness?
Well, he was given simultaneous doses of midazolam, which would be similar to a sedative of a type, Valium, for example, and a hydromorphone, which would be an opiate or a painkiller. These had never been used in an execution anywhere. They've been on Ohio's backup list method for a while. If they had ever had to be used in the past, they would have been injected into a muscle. That had never happened. Ohio has run out of its past execution drug, pentobarbital, and we can talk about why, but essentially that's what he was given, intravenous doses of those two drugs. And the point I've made is that typically in these executions, what you see is someone showing some kind of movement as the other drug would take effect. Maybe moving a little bit or stomach, chest rising, and then falling silent. And what we saw here was sort of the opposite. 5 or 6 minutes passed after the drugs began flowing where he simply was lying on the gurney, unconscious as far as we could see, to the point where I think, at least I thought, it was actually over. And then about 6 minutes in at 10:34 a.m., he gave a loud snorting sound. It's the best I can approximate it to, sort of like if you've ever seen a heavy person asleep, lying asleep and snorting or snoring suddenly. It took us all by surprise. And then for about the next 10 minutes, we saw some variation of that. My notes from that day are pretty consistent. I just wrote over and over a loud gasp as if snoring. I must have written that at least 10 times. Over the course of 10 or 12 minutes. His mouth would also just open and shut as though he was gasping or almost sort of yawning. And his stomach did rise and fall a few times. And then eventually it's sort of diminished. And the last thing I wrote down at 10:43 a.m. was I wrote down a yawn or a cough. And that was the last movement that I saw.
When you're witnessing the executions as a member of the media, are you in the same place as the family?
Yes, we're all in a witness room, and the family of the inmates, well, it depends. I think they vary where they sit, but there's essentially two seating areas. In this case, the inmate's family, his son, daughter and daughter-in-law were sitting on the left in three chairs. They're separated by a sort of partition from the relatives of the victim in this case. But the partition does not run all the way back, so we can move back and forth. And so essentially we're in the same room. We were moving back and forth quite a lot to sort of quietly and hopefully respectfully observe what the inmate's family was going through. And then purely from a reporting point of view, it's usually easier to see what's happening on the right side, which is where we would move back to as well.
We're talking about the execution of Dennis McGuire. He was sentenced to death for the 1989 rape and stabbing death of a young pregnant woman in Preble County. It was an execution that did not end as the state had intended. Joining me in the studio, Andrew Welsh Huggins of the Associated Press. He was just describing the event from last week. Also with us, Doug Berman, OSU law professor and death penalty expert. If you have any questions for our guests, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. When you're in the witness room, you describe the sounds, so you can hear what's going on as well.
To a degree, you're separated by a window. His final statement, any final statement is read through a microphone, so that's very easy to hear. But in this case, yeah, we could hear, some of these sounds. We probably missed some sounds simply because they were too indistinct.
Mm-hmm. Did you hear what was the people, the guards in the room with them, what they were saying, or were they not saying anything at all?
No, this is a pretty surreal and somber-looking scenario. So you have the warden standing, I guess it would be on the inmate's right side, and you have the execution team leader who is standing directly behind the inmate. The warden had his eyes square on Dennis McGuire almost the whole time, and they're not saying anything. They're simply watching there, observing. In the warden's case, he's determining at what point he can signal for someone to come in and see if death has occurred. At one point, according to I should point out that Ohio keeps these extremely detailed logs of executions, and in this
you're saying compared to other states,
definitely compared to other states, Ohio does have a pretty opaque execution system compared to a lot of other states, and so. This log indicates that at a certain point they conferred, presumably in a room where we couldn't see them, and they decided to wait an extra 5 minutes. That's a little bit unusual.
In the room, the warden, guards, and the person who administers the deadly drugs, whatever they might be, that's a guard too, right?
We don't really know.
Okay.
So in the death chamber itself, during the execution, is simply the inmate, the warden, and this execution team leader. In a room right next to it that we can't see would be someone administering the syringes and presumably, I think, the head of the prisons agency and some other people. The executioners in Ohio are volunteer employees of the Department of Rehabilitation and Correction. I believe, based on my past reporting, that a number of them are guards. They don't have to be, though. They could really be any employee, but they are DRC employees, and they volunteer for this role.
Is there a medical team on hand?
They call it a medical team, but it's the DRC execution medical team. Typically, they might have some experience as paramedics, EMTs, but there's no doctors.
No anesthesiologists,
no.
Because these drugs, and we're going to get into it more deeply later, but these are drugs that are used for surgeries and things like that usually.
Correct. And these two drugs in particular are commonly used for all types of surgeries.
It's unclear whether Dennis McGuire felt any pain, though, right? That's still not clear.
I would say it's completely unclear. Neither of these two drugs is a pain-inducing drug. Midazolam is a sedative, and one of the things that the little I know about it is it's used in some cases. It has a I forget the medical term, but it can cause you to forget things. So it's a preferred drug in some surgeries, especially if you're going to have a repeated procedure and they want to reduce the trauma you're feeling. You don't remember much about what happened. And painkillers are called painkillers for a reason. They reduce pain, and as we all know, when they're abused, they can make you feel pretty good. So neither of those two drugs is pain-causing. There's a phenomenon that occurs called obstructed breathing, which is pretty much the way it sounds, and it's quite possible, based on what I observed, that he was simply having difficulty breathing because the soft tissues in his airways were relaxing through a combination of the drugs. He was very overweight, and that's a common thing that happens in patients who are overweight and they're anesthetized, is that they have that obstructed breathing.
Whether the anesthetization is meant to kill them or not.
That's right.
Or the anesthetic, I should say. Doug, you've said that the first of all, the state hasn't said anything yet.
That's right. That's
Does
my
the state
understanding.
Have to say anything?
I don't think it has to say anything, though it's inevitable. You heard and you mentioned that the family of Dennis McGuire plans to bring a lawsuit. The state will have to respond to that in some kind of way. And indisputably, not just the ACLU is asking for a moratorium, but the next set of death row defendants who are due to be executed, presumptively using the same method, are going to be bringing new litigation challenges. And so the state's at the very least going to have to respond in court. What I think is likely is probably over the next couple weeks, there will be a response that tries to some degree, get ahead of any of the court action, whether that response is a claim that there was no pain and that this didn't go as badly as it might have looked, or whether that claim is, you know, we need some more time to study this, to talk to experts in the field about how we should now respond to what obviously has gotten a lot of attention, but still has a lot of uncertainty built around it, in part because this was a new approach to execution.
McGuire's lawyer did challenge the method beforehand, right?
Yeah, that's right. And there's
court say then?
Well, there's been an incredibly long history, as Ohio has had a number of different difficulties with its execution protocol. And there's a long story here that other states are struggling with as well. Mm-hmm. The traditional method used to be a three-drug cocktail. And what's interesting about that history is there was lots of litigation saying it looks like the executed prisoner has no pain, but if the drugs aren't administered properly, they're actually being tortured silently. And so the allegations by a number of defense attorneys to the old three-drug approach was that it looked like it was painless, but it may in fact be very, very painful. And there was some medical testimony to support that idea, partially because of those complaints, partially because of a botched execution that Ohio had a couple years ago. Ohio switched to a one-drug method, and that was a pioneering decision. And a number of other states followed when Ohio seemed to have great success with this one drug method that Andrew referenced earlier. But when we ran out of those drugs, that's when they moved to this backup plan with these two drugs. And throughout every change, lawyers representing those on death row have said, you shouldn't be experimenting. This is untried. This is untested. There could be unnecessary suffering. What the courts had said is, well, we're going to keep an eye on this. And the state is representing. They're trying everything possible to avoid any unnecessary pain. And I think in part because the one drug method worked well, relatively speaking, that the court was inclined to say, well, Ohio now seems to kind of know what it's doing. We'll keep an eye on this, but we're going to let this two drug approach go forward. Whether the court will want to revisit that conclusion in light of what's happened. Mm-hmm. Again, it's inevitable litigation will take place. What else is going to happen is to be determined.
We are talking about the execution last week that we're not sure if it went wrong or not, or if that's just the way it has to be. My guest, Andrew Welsh Huggins of the Associated Press, and also Doug Berman, OSU law professor and death penalty expert. We will continue. We're going to talk about the issue of what we can stand to do when it comes to the death penalty. And we'll talk about more about that three-drug approach that was abandoned and why. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the recent execution of Dennis McGuire by the state of Ohio. McGuire appeared to gasp and choke for several minutes after the lethal injections were administered last week. His family has said they plan a lawsuit. The ACLU has asked Governor Kasich to suspend further executions for the time being. Five are on deck now. The soonest is set for March. Still with us, Andrew Welsh Huggins, legal affairs reporter for the Associated Press and author of a book about the death penalty in Ohio. It's called No Winners Here Tonight: Race, Politics, and Geography in One of the Country's Busiest Death Penalty States. Also with us still is OSU law professor and death penalty expert Douglas Berman. Thanks again, both of you, for joining us today. Doug, you've said that the question may center ultimately on the state's tolerance for a constitutional method that's hard to watch.
I think that's right. And I think the one thing that everybody would, I think, agree with what happened, even with the uncertainty about whether Mr. McGuire experienced pain in the process, is it didn't look as peaceful as past lethal injections have looked. And in fact, the move towards lethal injection, everybody, I think, should recognize, was an effort to change the aesthetic of the death penalty as much, if not more, than change the reality of it. Various people debate in various different ways whether old traditional forms of execution, my understanding is if you do hanging right, it's painless, but it could be painful if you do it wrong. Similarly, a firing squad or the guillotine, you know, famously historically was invented by a doctor in an effort to try to create a painless execution method in France. And so there has been a longstanding historical tradition of believing that avoiding extreme pain is an appropriate thing for a state to try to do when they carry out this punishment. But what all those methods demonstrated is it doesn't look very good when you see somebody hanging, especially if they're flailing around. The electric chair, famously, of course, looks gruesome both in the apparatus used and in the very physicality of somebody being shocked literally to death. And so lethal injection emerged as first Oklahoma, then Texas, embraced the idea that we could use a more medicalized procedure and make it look painless. And in fact, some of the criticisms of lethal injection has been it looks too easy. You know, I've heard some pro-death penalty advocates and particularly some victims' families say, you know, he got to die so peacefully and my loved one who he killed didn't have that. And so it's been controversial, ironically, because it seems so painless. And yet, as medical evidence developed and as other concerns arose, that may have just been the impression rather than the reality.
It's interesting, Andrew, as we're talking about this, are we talking about the person being put to death, or are we talking about the pain inflicted on the people who have to watch it and the discomfort they feel watching it? Because when I go back to that quote from Dennis McGuire Jr., it was the most awful moment in my life to witness my dad's execution. I can't think of any way to describe it other than torture. And the way he said it, you could take it a couple different ways. It was torture for him to watch his father die that way, or was it torture for his father to die that way?
You know, I've watched a lot of people watch their relatives die, and I can't imagine what that's like. The one of the issues here is, as Doug was alluding to, is the law was created to exact punishment. The punishment in death penalty cases is the sentence of death. The process is not meant to be punitive. We have a constitutional prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment, and that's what we're talking about, this evolution to try to create something that is that carries out the sentence. We can debate the topic all day, but that is the ultimate sentence. A person is losing their life for a crime that he or she committed. I can't imagine what Dennis McGuire, that was also the son's name, went mm-hmm. through. I'm not sure what the state's requirements are to shelter a relative in that situation.
Oh, and just to sort of add, part of the dilemma here is that we're not just focused on the family of the condemned prisoner who's being executed. There's also typically family members, friends, others of the victim of the offense. And many people, I think, rightly express concern, often because there's so much time between the crime. Right now, it's just about 25 years from the time that Dennis McGuire committed the crime that led to his sentence of death and this ultimate execution, that we've sort of lose sight of their perception. And at the same time, we also have a lot of ambivalence about suppose the victim's family or others, including maybe members of society, would actually like Mr. McGuire to suffer a painful death. Our constitutional principles say that's inappropriate, but I think, in fact, I know from listening to some of the commentary since this execution, there's a strong kind of public sentiment that why are we working so hard to try to avoid every last little bit of pain when that's the antithesis of what we think the person's being executed for creating incredible pain, not just obviously in his direct victim who he killed, but also in the family members who suffered the loss and continue to suffer that loss.
More of an eye for an eye.
That's right. And I was actually saying to my students just yesterday that if you really are very committed to that balancing of scales notion of retributivist justice, then in some sense you might think it's appropriate to have a painful death that tries to kind of recalibrate the balance given what the defendant did. Now, that's not our constitutional standard,
right?
We think we do enough when we just have the termination of life. But that's, again, where there's an underlying both, I think, ambivalence about this punishment. And even though, as Andrew put his finger on, we're not trying to be punitive in the way we administer this punishment, the reality is not just when we talk about the death penalty, other punishments we use as well, the method of applying it often not only gets punitive, but for many people is the worst part of the punishment. And we have to accept that with prison. We know that's uncomfortable, even though we say that's just about the deprivation of liberty. All sorts of other kinds of punishments will necessarily create different kinds of suffering, again, not just for the person being punished, but for family members, loved ones, the community. And so that's why this issue captures a lot of, you might say, kind of tension in our own feelings about what the most ultimate punishment should be trying to achieve and whose interests are most important when we have these moments of tension and uncertainty because something like this takes place.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the execution last week. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Devin in Dublin, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Devin.
Hi. I was going to ask about, as a method of killing people, inert gas asphyxiation, where you take something, for instance, like nitrogen, and use that to suffocate them, which, as I've read, creates no pain, is, you know, very effective. And so I was wondering, is it that it's that people want the retributive justice, or is there some other reason not to use that?
And doesn't I go
well,
either?
Well, I've heard from a number of people, especially since lethal injection has had these new problems with drug acquisition and the like, that a gas chamber approach, which it sounds like the caller is suggesting, likely would be the most painless way to change methods. However, both I think the history of totalitarian regimes, the Nazis most obviously using the gas chamber to kill innocents, combined with another understanding that I have is that though painless, can also be quite ugly. That it
again, it's about us.
Yeah, and which is understandable because we're the only ones left, right? You might say, you know, there's obviously, you know, dozens of methods to kill people. We've had that through history. And so I do think it's accurate to say that what methods we're choosing and what methods we're even considering is really much more about what we think we are as a society than it is about getting the job done, as it were.
Andrew Walsh Huggins, did you get any sense from the victims, the woman, the family of the woman who is raped and stabbed to death, any reaction from them about how this came out?
Not really. And in fact, you probably couldn't have had two more different reactions to the event. Dennis McGuire's adult children were very upset. It was as difficult a scene as I've ever witnessed for an inmate's family. Joy Stewart's relatives sat respectfully. One of them had a Bible, and there was very little reaction from them. And I certainly haven't heard anything from them about the about concerns about how this went. But I also haven't necessarily heard them in the forefront of people demanding to know why this wasn't why we're so concerned about what he went through.
Mm-hmm. Devin in Dublin, thanks a lot for that call. The executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center said that because of Ohio now, states will have more of a burden to show that they are using a well-thought-out best practice. But how can they when lethal injection methods are all experimental now? And I don't know whether it was Andrew or Doug said, well, they need to experiment more. Well, what in the world do you experiment on? Even if you do a large animal, they can't tell you how they feel.
Well, I think both those things are true. The states are going to scramble to see what they can use, and I do think they're going to be under even more scrutiny. The big example we're going to see is these compounded versions of the drugs they used in the past. In fact, Ohio's policy actually does call for the first choice to be a compounded version of pentobarbital, which is what Ohio used to use. But this is a totally different bird. This is a drug that's created in a specialty lab. It's not monitored by the FDA. Ohio says it has not been able to obtain that yet, although other states have. But the fact that Ohio made certain arguments in federal court about this new drug system and the fact that it panned out this way, I agree. I mean, I think judges are going to want even more evidence from states as they have to look to a variety of drugs. That, you know, we're getting close to being out of execution drugs in this country, and I think a lot of states were probably looking at this execution very carefully because it could and it may still well provide their answers.
35 states have the death penalty, I think, now.
A little less than that, I think.
Less
now,
than
yeah.
Someone just dropped it. Okay. Do they all use the injection method? Is that or
that,
not?
Yeah, I mean, that's become the national norm. And for about a decade in the 90s, it was a norm without any real controversy over it. And that's why more and more states went away from the electric chair, which had proven very controversial and very aesthetically uncomforting. In Florida, particularly, they had a pretty gruesome a case where an inmate started bleeding from the head and nose during the execution. And so more and more states, as there was litigation in the 80s and 90s over the electric chair, started moving to lethal injection. And because the three-drug protocol that was pioneered by Oklahoma and quickly adopted by Texas and was used a lot in those settings appeared to work so well. Again, it depends on how you want to define work. Work, certainly everyone, they administered the drugs properly to would be dead relatively quickly and would just lie on the table and be motionless along the way. What then led, there was actually a notable medical report in a journal called The Lancet that had claimed from doing autopsies of a variety of folks who had this combination of drugs that it was possible that all the drug combination had done is made the patient or the person being executed still, but not
pain-free.
And so that led to a wave of litigation that actually got all the way up to the Supreme Court, in which the Supreme Court said, well, essentially, as long as the state is trying to use best practices, the fact that it might go wrong every so often or we can't do this perfectly, that's not a reason alone to call essentially this kind of experimentation unconstitutional. But even though it may not be unconstitutional to be tweaking methods as long as you're trying to avoid unnecessary pain, it leads to reasonable charges. Should we be in the business of human experimentation this way, especially? And again, this is what we're seeing now some states talk about. We have other tried and true methods, even though we may not like what they look like. Whether I've heard two states already talking about the firing squad. Missouri's attorney general has said we should consider the gas chamber, given his sense, and I think it's an astute sense, that the litigation and the uncertainty over the drugs for lethal injection is not going to go away. It might be solved in the short term by compounding approaches, or again, this is why, as Andrew said, other states were following. I think they were hoping maybe Ohio has once again pioneered a new, simpler method. And that's what Ohio actually had achieved a couple of years ago with the one drug method, and other states were moving there.
Well, let's talk about why the one drug method is going away. What is the problem with the shortage of the drugs? Why is the United States running out of drugs? Andrew?
complicated question and answer with a very simple lead-in. Europe. The first one drug method Ohio used with sodium thiopental, the last manufacturer of that was only going to manufacture it in an Italy factory. The Italian authorities made it very plain they had no interest in manufacturing this if they couldn't guarantee it would not end up being used in U.S. executions. That drug is was taken, put off limits. Pentobarbital was used, quote, successfully, but then its Danish manufacturer was under a lot of pressure to stop its use in executions, and it put in place a prohibition on it being used. When that drug was sold to a U.S. manufacturer, that prohibition stayed in the purchase clause, however that works. So those two drugs, which Ohio and other states had used very successfully, those are essentially giant doses of sedatives that truly just shut a person down.
And you just overdose.
Overdose. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a horrible analogy, but similar to putting an animal down. Those drugs themselves were not available. And the last of those that people talked about was propofol, which people will, if you've heard of propofol, it's because pop singer Michael Jackson, that's what he overdosed on. Missouri was poised to use propofol, but then the same situation arose. The Association of Anesthesiologists were very worried that European manufacturers were going to put this off limits as well, not just for executions, but they just wouldn't make it available in the U.S., and that would have a terrible effect on just hospitals and surgeries.
Why aren't there American manufacturers? Why are we so dependent on European manufacturers for these drugs?
Ooh, that's a good globalization question that I don't think
It's about markets. It's bigger than...
I'd also add, even if there were American manufacturers, the medical community has been understandably concerned about what they would perceive to be the kind of effort to medicalize the execution process. So part of it is a story of Europe having a strong set of modern norms against the death penalty. But part of it, I think, also is just sensible business. You don't want the drug that's being regularly used in hospitals for regular surgeries to be now known as the execution drug of choice. How comfortable is a patient going in for surgery hearing, well, you know, we're giving you propofol before your surgery starts, and, well, wait a minute, isn't that what I hear they're using in Missouri to execute people? And so I think it's not just a moral reservation. It's a sort of sensible business reality that to be associated with executions itself has some negative impacts for those who manufacture these drugs and want to use them for obviously more traditional medical purposes.
Take a quick call from Don in Cincinnati. Don, you're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning. I maybe just need to make a statement instead of a question.
Well, actually, you did have a question here.
Right. Well, the question was that why does the governor feel that he can play doctor and experiment with people's lives when he doesn't really know what he's doing?
Okay.
You've answered some of that, but I just feel that he's wrong to do that.
Okay. The governor doesn't really, I'm just supposing, doesn't really have a lot to do with the decisions?
Not on the actual process and the drugs. I mean, the governor does have his clemency powers in death penalty case, but that has nothing to do with the process. I mean, that's delegated to the Department of Rehabilitation and Correction and prison officials, corrections officials who figure out what to do.
And once again, they have not responded to any of this publicly as far as what they're going to do with the upcoming executions in March and so forth.
They haven't, and I think Doug hit it exactly on the head. What we're going to see here very soon is more litigation, not necessarily in this lawsuit that the family filed, but in this long-running litigation over the lethal injection. We'll see filings very soon that will bear directly on what just happened, and that's where you'll see the state respond.
Okay, coming up, we're going to hear from a professor of surgery at OSU to talk about what these drugs do, about that three drug combination, and what it does. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the recent execution of Dennis McGuire by the state of Ohio. McGuire appeared to gasp and choke for several minutes after the lethal injections were administered. It was an experimental method of execution. Ohio was forced to try something new because the old methods no longer are available. Still with us, Associated Press legal affairs reporter Andrew Welsh Huggins, OSU law professor and death penalty expert Doug Berman. Joining us now to talk about the drugs is Dr. Jonathan Groner, a professor of clinical surgery at Ohio State University. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann.
How would or could drugs for death penalty be tested in the United States?
That's a great question, Ann. Ironically, the electric chair had a significant amount of research by Thomas Edison, tested all sorts of animals. As far as we know, the original lethal injection protocol was written out on a dinner napkin and had no testing. I mean, no mouse, rat, gerbil, any animal was ever tested with those drugs or any drugs for lethal injection. So it is hard not to think of the death penalty without thinking about human experimentation.
And you've said that in the old three-drug combination, each drug was being used for what it was designed for. Can you break that down for us?
Sure. The traditional three-drug execution method involved a barbiturate, thiopental, which renders someone unconscious. And it's not used in the operating room anymore today, but there was a time when it was used a little bit more. And in fact, recent news accounts about there was a race car driver who was in a horrible skiing crash, and they said he was in a medically induced coma. Well, that's barbiturate coma. So those drugs do that. The second drug was a muscle relaxing drug called Pavulon, which stops breathing. And then the last drug is potassium chloride, which, every day in operating rooms where heart surgery is done is used to arrest the heart. So it was designed to simulate anesthesia, and the drugs were doing what they were supposed to do. They were just using it to kill people, obviously. And the concerns about the muscle paralyzing drug masking symptoms, I think, has already been mentioned. And the point is that, I'm a surgeon. I'm not an anesthesiologist, but there's something called the surgical plane of anesthesia, which means that someone is so deeply anesthetized that you can cut them open, which sounds graphic, but that's basically what I do for a living. I cut people open to do operations. And midazolam and hydromorphone aren't really designed to do that. And in fact, what Mr. McGuire got for his execution was pretty close to what I got from my recent colonoscopy, but just larger doses. And so it's not a general anesthetic.
That's that twilight drug a lot of us.
Right, yes. And I claim to have woken up during my colonoscopy and watched part of it, although my gastroenterologist said that wasn't true. But the point is that these drugs are not, is not general anesthesia. And then there's a whole separate issue, which hasn't been discussed that much, about vascular access. Are the IVs really in? And Ohio has a bad track record on that account. There are at least three inmates where the IVs were known to not have been in, including one where it was abandoned after 2 hours. So, and that's an issue that's not really been discussed, but you have to wonder when someone, was not dying after getting medications, not going to, were the drugs actually being delivered into the vein?
Right. I mean, there is no, as far as we know, there's no anesthesiologist per se on board. But we're not sure.
I would say there's not.
There's
at all.
Not.
I don't think there's one in Ohio that would.
There's been attempts in other states. In California, there's actually litigation. There, the judge demanded that an anesthesiologist be present, and two anesthesiologists volunteered. And then they said, "Well, by the way, if there's a problem, you guys have to intervene." And they said, "Oh no, we don't want anything about that." So, we think the highest level of medical skill in the execution chamber is someone who's an EMT.
So if. Could it make a difference? I mean, as far as ruling out those kinds of mistakes, would it make a difference to have an anesthesiologist, someone?
Well, absolutely. But therein lies the dilemma that the people who are most able to make sure that the execution works are the least able to participate. I mean, that's exactly the crux of the problem with lethal injection is that it's a medicalized procedure. It requires medical expertise. It requires, if you saw the death chamber in Lucasville, and Andrew can comment on that, it looks a little like outpatient surgery. I mean, there's a stretcher, and there's IV tubing, and there's IV bags hanging, and so forth. And some of them look very much like outpatient surgery. And some of them even use the same stretchers that we use in our outpatient surgery department. I mean, it is designed to simulate a medical procedure, but without the medical expertise, it is predictable that it will fail on occasion.
And I'll just add a number of other states have pretty notorious histories with the types of persons who end up being their kind of regular administrators of drugs. So Missouri in particular has had lots of controversy because it was a disbarred or I forget the term, but unlicensed doctor who was doing the executions there and who on the stand as part of litigation over the way Missouri was going about its lethal injection admitted he was dyslexic and repeatedly admitted that he often got the amount of the drugs confused. And so one of the stories of the modern litigation over lethal injection is because not only is the reputable members of the medical profession generally resistant to playing an active role, but that sometimes it's attracted folks not only who are not trained or specialized in these areas, but who have a variety of inabilities to conduct these procedures in ways that we would think it would be, you know, necessary, let alone essential.
Drug makers won't provide the drugs in one case because the manufacturers of it live in Italy, and Italy doesn't want that a drug that will be used in the death penalty manufactured. But some compound pharmacies will do it, and that just brings up that issue. Now, there are some that are regulated by the FDA, I guess, and they won't do it, but some go under the radar. Dr. Groner, can you tell us about that? What are all these distinctions as far as pharmacies are concerned, and why do they matter?
Well, it's a complicated issue. I mean, one issue you could even ask is how does the prison actually get these drugs? I mean, hydromorphone is a narcotic that requires a physician's prescription. And so how are they even getting the drugs?
Right.
So there's a lot of subterfuge involved. I know with the back in the thiopental controversy when that was sort of fading because it was at one time made in a Chicago suburb that they traced the supplier to a storefront in England that was next to a driving school. So, I mean, there's a lot of subterfuge. There's a lot of, you know, and so it gets kind of scary. And, you know, why is this executions that are supposedly being done for a public good? Why is there so much secrecy and subterfuge? Why do we not know who's in the execution chamber? You know, in Columbus, some of the people involved in the executions actually testified behind a screen, you know, so they couldn't see who they were. So there's a lot of secrecy surrounding it, which suggests that it may not be the, moral imperative that the Department of Corrections wants us to think it is.
Andrew Welsh Huggins, I mean, is the state getting the drugs in a less than completely above board way?
We don't know.
Well,
they are obtaining these drugs. I mean, I don't think they're breaking the law, but there's a very gray area out there. They say they haven't been able to obtain the compounded pentobarbital, which I'm pretty sure is what they really want, because assuming it would work some way similar to the former drug, it's probably better for them than what just happened.
And I just wanted to add that, you know, it's a little bit of the state being stuck between a rock and a hard place because my sense is, especially when they went from the three-drug approach to the one-drug approach, they reached out to any and every expert who was kind of willing to help them. And understandably, many folks in the medical profession, many folks in the anesthesiology arena are highly disinclined to take an active role in not only talking about these issues, but particularly sort of being the doctor who kind of solves this problem, whether it's solvable or not. And so I worry it's not that the state is trying to sort of have black helicopters out there and secretly do this. I think it's as transparent as they'd like to try to be. It's very difficult for them. And one of the debates that took place actually in North Carolina was an effort by the North Carolina Medical Association to threaten to de-license any doctor who had any role in the process. And that became its own source of litigation where the North Carolina Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that, medical association. But again, you can understand why the medical profession is justifiably concerned about a state kind of openly and notoriously using doctors and other members of the medical profession to help them in the task of state killing.
Have pharmacies and doctors been harassed or picketed or anything like that in the past for providing drugs?
I think there's lots of discussion of that being a concern. So one of the justifications we often hear from the state for this kind of secrecy is, don't you know there are you know, strong moral views here. And so just like we'll see abortion clinics picketed, if there's a compounding pharmacy that's well known to do this, we're going to see pickets out there. And we want to protect folks and allow them to do the work without being subject to that. I think it tends to be a little bit more supposition and fear than it is actuality that we see, you know, real threats or intimidation against groups that are involved in this. But I do think it's accurate that there are folks against the death penalty so strongly that they would want to at least complain or otherwise, you know, suggest maybe an economic boycott of any pharmacy that was actively involved here. And so I don't think there's sort of deep harassment at issue, but there certainly are reputational consequences.
Dr. Groner, Doug Berman brought up earlier the business aspect of it, and you kind of touch upon it there when you're talking about it that way. But just the medical business of it is when you're performing a surgery, you want your patient to be perfectly confident in what you're doing and how you, what drugs you're using. And the last thing you want is for them to know that you might be using a drug that is used for to kill people.
Right. I mean, even with Michael Jackson's unfortunate death, you know, we heard about that. You know, isn't this the drug? You know, propofol is a drug that we use every single day. It is a fantastic drug for induction for anesthetic. And, you know, again, I'm not an anesthesiologist, but I actually can't remember what they used to use before we had propofol. I mean, I'm sure in the city it's probably being used 100 to 200 times a day. It's just a very, very common induction agent, particularly for children, which is what I do. So if that manufacturer said, well, we're not giving it to the United States because it might be used for executions, it would be really hard. So, I mean, from that, you know, that's sort of a flip side of it. But again, just, you know, the idea of physicians being in the execution chamber, you know, would you want the person who executed Mr. McGuire to be, you know, giving you your drugs for your appendectomy? And I think the answer is probably no. I'm not sure that's so much business as that's just the ethics of it that, you know, as physicians, and I'm particularly sensitive to this because I take care of children, you know, we have this bond with our patients that is very important and cannot be violated. I mean, frequently when I'm on call at the hospital, I will meet a family. And, you know, 10 minutes after I'm introduced to them, I'm taking their child back for an operation that they can't see. And sometimes there's big emergencies and sometimes it's minor, but it doesn't matter to the family that, that bond between physician and patient is based on us only using our skills. And I think it applies to nurses, too, that the skills can only be used for healing, can never be used for harm. When you violate that trust, I think, you know, our status as professionals breaks down.
Email from Chris. What I am struck by today is the emphasis on the experience of the observers. On the one hand, I am opposed to the death penalty for three reasons. Simply stated, I believe it is immoral, cruel, and with respect to the notion of deterrence, it is ineffective. On the other hand, if we assume that deterrence is a significant and worthy goal, then it would seem that it should be as ugly as possible for it to have the desired impact. At the risk of hyperbole, if we are going to use the death penalty, maybe it should be broadcast to the public who it is supposed to deter, all of us. If we as a public believe we should enforce the death penalty, then we are obliged to take responsibility for the pain and suffering it causes. And it does get back to that question of who are we really talking about here, them or us, the ones that are put to death or the ones that have to watch it.
I think there's a great book that I would recommend to the writers. It's called Edison and the Electric Chair, and sort of goes through the whole history. And there were public hangings in Columbus, and there were people who got their wallets stolen at public hangings in Columbus. So the deterrent value is hard to measure, we'll just say that. But if someone's interested in the history of this, and I think it's a reasonable question.
Yeah, and I think the history actually, you know, gives us some interesting guides because public executions were the norm throughout most of American history, really all the way up until World War II, and there was a sort of growing sense that it became spectacle and sport rather than a serious effort to show the public the consequences of crime. And so that's where we ended up moving it inside the prison walls. Whether that's the right result and whether that helps us at this day and age is an enduring question.
OSU Law Professor Doug Berman, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
AAP reporter Andrew Walsh Huggins, thanks again for joining
You're
us
welcome.
As well. And Dr. Jonathan Groner, professor of clinical surgery at OSU, thanks to you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.